Welcome to Oncology Today, Management of Peripheral T-Cell Lymphoma. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Stephen Horowitz from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City. In addition to this interview, there's also a corresponding video recording featuring Dr. Horowitz's slide presentation. To begin, I asked him for his thoughts on the evolving treatment landscape of peripheral T-cell lymphomas.
As we're understanding the biology, we're starting to match that with therapy. It's not always on target, CD30 is on target, but some of the things like epigenetic modifying agents with what we now think is the biggest subtype, which are follicular helper T-cell lymphomas, which were the old term angioimmunoblastic T-cell lymphoma, and now a larger group that come from a similar cell of origin or similar cell state. Those almost always develop on a background of clonal hematopoiesis, and they really have like an example of different responses to some of our therapies. So I think that understanding and individualizing, I think, is our next step forward.
And you mentioned kind of the classification, and at least from my point of view, trying to help out general oncologists, in a way, it kind of reminds me a little bit of soft tissue sarcomas. And it's very rare. And yet when you talk to the sarcoma people, they're always trying to explain, look, they're not all the same, et cetera. So do you want to take a shot at, particularly from the point of view of a general medical oncologist who's particularly interested in, you know, sort of more practical issues, about how your vision of these cancers has evolved over the years? And particularly, I heard that term follicular helper T-cell, and I'm like, where did that come from? So how long has that been out there?
Yeah. So I think if you think about the main nodal subtypes, there's like 30 different kinds. So some of them need their own discussion, but the main nodal subtypes are three basic baskets. There's anaplastic large cell lymphoma, strong CD30 expressing. And there we have brentuximab based therapy with curative intent, and that's been a step forward. We have follicular helper T cell lymphoma. So it gets complicated. There we think the cell of origin, if that's the right term, is a T cell that's normal home is the germinal center, and it's a follicular helper T cell. They're usually like CD4 positive. They have CD10 expression. They often have PD1 expression. And that's a different cell than sort of the cytotoxic T cells or the gamma delta T cells. So angioimmunoblastic T cell lymphoma, which is now sort of the main kind of follicular helper T cell lymphoma. So if you think like B-cell lymphomas, it's a cell of origin like germinal center. You know, you could think of it analogous to that. Gets a little more complicated than T-cell lymphoma. It may not be cell of origin. It may be cell state, but we can put that aside for now. But if you think about that, that's probably the majority of the nodal T-cell lymphomas that a doctor would see in the U.S. or Western Europe is from one of these follicular helper T-cells. And those will be called angioimmunoblastic T-cell lymphoma or some term of follicular helper T-cell lymphoma in the classification. And then there's PTCL-NOS, which was still sort of a wastebasket term with a lot of different heterogeneous groups. So that's sort of the third category that don't neatly fit into those other buckets.
So from a practical therapeutic point of view, how do these different classifications translate? Because it kind of seems like all roads lead to CHOP plus or minus BV if they're CD30 positive, regardless, or am I not getting that right?
Yeah, I think for a non-clinical trial, good standard of care, I think it would be CHOP or CHOP-etoposide plus or minus BV. On the research front, we have some early data that adding epigenetic modifying agents may improve the progression-free or maybe cure rate for follicular helper T cells. That sort of subset analysis and ongoing study. So I would say that's not current standard of care, but it's maybe coming. And then for the other peripheral T cell lymphoma NOS, they do worse with the same therapy. So how we do better there is still in evolution.
So when you think about the clinical presentation of these subtypes, how do they vary? And what are the significant differences between them, again, from a clinical point of view?
So for anaplastic large cell lymphoma, it's usually bulky nodal disease. They're either ALK positive or ALK negative, but both of those subtypes we would treat with BV plus chemotherapy with pretty good cure rates. They sometimes have extranodal disease like bone involvement and stuff like that, but they're more typically nodal. Follicular helper or angioimmunoblastic T-cell lymphomas can be kind of variable. They often have diffuse low volume adenopathy, sometimes low SUVs. There's a lot of systemic symptoms like rash, fever, polyclonal gammopathies that can be associated with them. So sometimes they're a little hard to figure out. They sometimes present with like hemolytic anemia or immune thrombocytopenias. They often have a component of EBV reactive B cells in the mix. So sometimes the histology can be a little tricky. But we now know that almost all the time they develop on a background of clonal hematopoiesis, where you have some founder mutations and then you have additional private mutations in the follicular helper T cell lymphoma. So that kind of figures into the biology. And then, like I said, that's starting to inform therapy, where at least in the relapse setting, epigenetically targeted therapies like histone deacetylase inhibitors and hypomethylating agents and maybe coming EZH inhibitors seem to have better efficacy than they do in other types of T cell lymphoma.
I'm still trying to understand, Chip. Can you explain why all, are there any other situations where everybody has a history of CHIP at what you just said for a follicular helper T cell? That seems kind of unusual.
Yeah, I mean, I only know about T cell lymphomas, so I don't think I know if there's other cancers that are, you know, universally on CHIP, but we see I can just tell you what we see, which is we see the TET2 or DNMT3A in a broad hematopoietic compartment. And then that's almost everybody with follicular helper T cell lymphoma. And then you'll see additional mutations in the T cell lymphoma compartment that we don't see in the myeloid. Interestingly, those patients also have a higher rate of developing B cell lymphomas, and you see the same founder mutations in the B cells, but different private mutations in the B cell lymphomas. But I don't think, other than follicular helper T cell lymphoma, anything I know of where it's almost universal.
What is your vision for CHIP?
Well, I don't treat CHIP primarily, so I'm not an expert in that. I think what we see in T-cell lymphomas is we may be able to exploit those mutations therapeutically, you know, doing studies looking at things like IDH mutations and see if we can target those specifically. So we think of it as a therapeutic opportunity, but I'm not a CHIP doctor. So for that large group of people that are just observed that have other medical consequences, I'm probably better asking somebody else.
In a second, I want to go through your cases, but again, just in terms of broad strokes, can you comment about CD30 testing and any potential pitfalls there?
Yeah, it's a routine immunohistochemistry, and I think we're pretty good at identifying any positivity. So I think most labs can tell you whether they're positive or not. I think you can ask for a quantification, and sometimes that's helpful for us at the very low levels in deciding therapy. But kind of the bottom line for a practitioner is more CD30 probably goes along with higher rates of response, but there's no lower cutoff that you can reliably apply to say there's no likelihood of response. So I think you kind of want to know if there's CD30 and then how much. And I showed in the talk, there is some data from CTCL, different disease, where below 5% may drop the response rate, but doesn't drop it to zero. So I think knowing any and then maybe getting a ballpark for the percentage involvement is probably good enough for clinical use.
What do you see in terms of percent positivity in the other peripheral T cell?
So anaplastic large cell lymphoma, almost all the cells are positive, so 80% or higher. Angiomyoblastic T cell lymphoma or follicular helper T cell, they tend to be low, kind of in the 10 to 20 or 30% range. So you have low positivity there, but pretty good rates of efficacy. And then PTCL NOS, because it's heterogeneous, you see across the board. You see very low, or you can see 80 or 90% that overlaps a lot with anaplastic large cell lymphoma.
And in patients who do not have CD30 positivity, you don't use brentuximab?
We generally don't. I would also mention the heterogeneity, which I mentioned in the talk too. So at least in CTCL, if you do multiple biopsies, you may see different rates at different sites. So you can rebiopsy. I think we don't use it a lot in CD30 negative, but we also have like a strong clinical trial portfolio where we have multiple other therapies to offer those patients. But because brentuximab is so safe and doctors are so comfortable with it, and we do have responses in you know, CD30 negative patients based on looking at one or two slides, not finding any CD30. I don't think it takes it off the table, but at least for us with all these other options, you know, we put it lower on the list.
And can you just kind of provide an update in terms of toxicity with BV? Of course, as you mentioned, clinicians now have a lot of experience with it. But what have we learned over the years, particularly in terms of reversibility of the toxicity that's seen?
Yeah, so mostly it's reversible. When we looked at long follow-up, like from the Echelon 2 study, about 80% of patients, now in that study, people were held once they got to grade 2, so people didn't get to grade 3 neuropathy. But if you hold at grade 1 or 2, about 80% of people fully recover, recover at least to grade 1, to where there's little functional impairment. That can take months to up to a year, but most people are reversible. Actually, the thing I just learned last week, actually, in a patient we saw who had very early, more severe neuropathy than expected, they ended up having demyelination on their EMGs. And there are a series of case reports now in the neurology literature where BV has been associated with CIDP. So it's something that may be treatable with IVIG. So it's something that I just learned this the other day, thinking about testing the patients that have earlier, more severe BV toxicity, BV neuropathy, looking at EMGs, and if there's evidence of demyelination, there could be an additional immune component. I think that's quite rare, but potentially, you know, really functionally changing for those patients.
That's really interesting. How is it managed?
Yeah. With IVIG, just like they do other CIDP.
What does CIDP stand for?
Chronic immune demyelinating polyneuropathy. So it's sort of like the more chronic indolent form of Guillain-Barré. And there's been now a series of case reports in neurology literature. A neurologist just pointed this out to me recently, where BV toxicity has shown patterns of that and has responded to IVIG. So in these patients, like this, for instance, was a patient that after one dose of BV developed neuropathy and after three had to stop. So very severe early neuropathy that you don't typically see, you know, after 10 or 12 or 16 doses. And it may be a clue that those patients have an additional pathophysiology that could be treated other than just holding the therapy and observing.
Really interesting. I never heard of that. And it sounds really interesting.
I hadn't either. And I've given a lot of BV. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure you have. I'm curious, where things are in terms of relapse disease. It looks like we still have a lot of the former agents still are being utilized that have been utilized for a while. Can you kind of provide an overview of how you think through relapse disease and then maybe talk a little bit about some of the trials you're involved with that you're excited about?
And so for relapse disease, you know, we still have curative intent is probably an allotransplant, and that's best done in CR, close to CR. Or palliative therapy or maintenance therapy. So our initial decision is sort of, are we pushing towards allo, trying to get a quick CR and then moving forward, or are we really trying to find something that's long-term maintainable? The older agents that we have are things like pralatrexate. We still have romidepsin available. We have belinostat. Those are both HDAC inhibitors. So when we think about those, like the HDAC inhibitors overall have a 25 or 30% response rate, but in the follicular helper T-cell lymphomas, they have more of a 50% response rate. So in a patient with relapsed disease of follicular helper subtype, that would be a primary choice if you're looking at sort of currently available agents. And then there's off-label use of hypomethylating agents like azacitidine. Probably that activity is only in follicular helper T-cell lymphomas. And we're getting more data on duvelisib, PI3 kinase inhibitor and T-cell lymphoma, which it looks like in the phase 2 study, there's about a 50% response rate overall, probably over 60% in follicular helper T-cell lymphomas, probably much lower in anaplastic large cell. So we kind of look at the subtypes, we look at the goals, and then kind of choose from the available options, if we're just dealing with available options, or look towards sort of clinical trials for newer alternate therapies. In terms of the newer agents on clinical trial, I think probably the next one that'll be published soon is valemetostat, which is an EZH1-2 inhibitor. And in a phase one and then a follow-on phase two study of relapsed peripheral T-cell lymphoma, high rates of response around 50%, higher in follicular helper T-cell lymphoma, like we might think with an epigenetically targeted agent, but good responses across subtypes, including HTLV-1 T-cell lymphomas. So that data was presented, the papers will be out soon, and my hope would be in the next year or two that that therapy may be available for patients.
Let's talk about a couple of things that have come along in the last couple of years that have had a big effect on the field. First of all, the Echelon 2 study. Could you kind of just go back over the original thinking when that was designed and how that actually played out?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, we had the data with BV at that time for anaplastic large cell lymphoma, very high rates of response, very high rates of complete responses. Then we had kind of smaller phase two data for other types of T cell lymphoma. So the thought was, could you add that to chemotherapy to, you know, increase cure rates? In the phase one, you know, there was such a high CR rate with anaplastic large cell lymphoma, we didn't really know if you needed to combine it. So there was a sequential BV followed by CHOP arm, and then a BV combination with CHP dropping the vincristine. And both those arms looked pretty reasonable, but the CR rate for untreated patients was not that high, or not high enough that you thought like that would be a done deal by itself. So the arm that went forward was BV plus CHP. A lot of discussion on whether to use add CHOEP, chopotopicide, or EPOC, or these other more intense regimens. And I think what we finally settled on was, you know, we had registry data that about 80% of people worldwide were treated with CHOP. So that would be the comparator for the study, but there could be room to add. And then thinking that if there was a group that would have a benefit, and the study was powered for progression-free survival, that would be the ALCL component. So that group was independently powered, and then really just trying to get additional data for the other subtypes. So that kind of was the design, even with looking at ALCL by itself and the overall population. You know, the study was 450 patients, so we already thought that was big for T-cell lymphoma. So in retrospect, it would have been nice to power like the AITL or the PTCL NOS subtype independently. But at the time, you know, we never completed a randomized study in untreated T-cell lymphoma. So there was a lot sort of unknown about how big a study we could accrue or how quickly.
That's really amazing to think about how much research has been done on smaller incidence tumors like peripheral T cell, but even going beyond that into subsets of non-small cell lung cancer, NTRK, you know, et cetera. But, you know, to me, peripheral T cell was one of the first rare tumors that showed you can do randomized trials.
Yeah.
And then we started to see that in other cancers after that. But I think you all, I think really maybe using a lot of advocacy support. I don't know how you managed to get those early studies done like this one.
Yeah, I mean, it went pretty well. I mean, I think a lot of it also was brentuximab being a therapy that people, oncologists were familiar with, had good experience with, easy to give. It didn't seem to be excessively toxic or complicated. So I think that helped a lot. And then the study was designed for like local pathology review to move people on quickly so we wouldn't have hurdles in getting patients on or losing patients.
So can you kind of summarize what we learned from that study in terms of the impact of BV, but also what we learned about chemotherapy dose intensification?
Yeah. So, the primary endpoint of the study was PFS. So that was better. It was, more than doubled for the BV arm. That definitely holds for the ALCL group. And pleasant surprise is the PFS benefit translated to an overall survival benefit, even though that wasn't the primary endpoint. We learned that adding BV to CHP didn't add toxicity compared to CHOP, so there was no increased toxicity that affected patients adversely. There was no reduction in dose intensity or dose delivery, so that was fortuitous. We didn't know that going in, that the safety would be the same. The other surprise that came out of there was the CHOP arm did better than expected. So the study read out later than expected because of the lack of events primarily in the CHOP arm. So we predicted that CHOP would have a median PFS of maybe 12 months, and it was double that. So in a prospective trial, CHOP did much better than historical databases of CHOP. So I think that's something we think about in treating patients, that CHOP is relatively ineffective, but maybe not as ineffective as we thought, you know, prior to doing a true prospective randomized study. And then in terms of dose intensity, there's a transplant bias in T-cell lymphoma where a lot of times we consolidate with auto transplant. That was not specified in the study because I think the thought was, let's just maximize patient availability. We won't want to include or exclude patients who may be appropriate for more intensive therapy. So that was looked at kind of on the back end. Hard to be conclusive, but it looks like if you look at the patients in complete remission who got transplant versus those who didn't, those patients still did better. And then there's some follow-on studies giving CHOP etoposide plus BV or CHEP plus BV, some phase two studies, some other studies looking at consolidation that I think, at least to me, suggest that there's still room for intensifying therapy to still do better in T-cell lymphoma beyond just adding BV.
How do you approach the issue of intensification in your own practice outside a clinical trial?
Yeah, we offer to most patients, you know, I think our internal data suggests that like consolidating with auto transplant probably pushes up the cure rate or reduces PFS by probably 10 to 20%. So if we talk about that with patients, you know, if there's a benefit in 1 in 10 or 1 in 5 by getting consolidation, it's at least a reasonable consideration. Most of our patients at MSK like are more maximalist in terms of therapy. So our patients tend to subscribe to that. And when it's offered, most of them do it or most of them want it. I think the benefit, or at least what we see in our data, is the benefit is really only for the chemosensitive patients. So having a CR or a near CR to your induction chemo predicts that you might benefit. Lack of a CR or only a PR to induction chemo to us suggests that you're not going to benefit. And we look at other options. And then we have some early data looking at genetics. So things like P53 alterations or some other markers of chemo resistance seem to select a group less likely to benefit. So yeah, sorry, it's all complicated and none of it's totally straightforward, but I think there's a group of people that look like they benefit, and those are the ones who are in CR at the end of treatment, who tolerated the chemotherapy well. So it suggests that adding the high dose therapy isn't going to be excessively toxic. And those are the people we discuss it with. And then most of our patients opt for it. In the absence of randomized data, you know, it's not mandatory, but it's what we think is like sort of the most reasonable you can do for an upfront cure rate or upfront attempt at cure.
What happens if you use CD30 as a cellular therapy target, you know, bispecific CAR T?
Yeah, the data is sort of emerging. So, the CD30 CAR T data looks okay. There was an early study done by Baylor. There's a follow-on study now going on at Baylor and University of North Carolina, where they're looking at CAR T targeting CD30. There are patients who do well. Some of those are CTCL. It's not like a home run for anaplastic large cell lymphoma, which I was a little surprised, at least at the early data that's been published or that we've seen. There's a mix of responders and people who progress right through it with persistent CD30 expression. So I think that's unclear. There's a CD30 bispecific sort of NK engager that's the study was done. Interestingly, in that study, the best responses were in angioimmunoblastic T-cell lymphoma and less good responses in anaplastic large cell lymphoma. So it's kind of a long way of saying, you know, it's just not a home run. It doesn't look as effective in the CD30 target, in the CD30 expressing T cell lymphomas as I thought it might. So there's ways of optimizing the cell therapy, the bispecific antibodies being added, NK cells are adding to that, where the data in Hodgkin's is fantastic and still to be determined in T cell lymphoma.
The data for what in Hodgkin's?
Hodgkin's. So the CD30, CD16 bispecific plus NK cells. So that was a study done out of MD Anderson for Hodgkin lymphoma. Looks very high response rates. Less clear how good it is in CD30 positive T cell lymphomas. The plenary at ASH was a sort of a tour de force of looking at different types of cell therapy, but it was included in that. And follow-on study is just, you know, sort of underway now.
What about the epigenetic route? You know, whenever I think, you know, hear about that, my basic simple mind, I just start thinking about hypomethylating agents and that maybe it's not going to be that effective. Is that too simple a way to look at it?
No, I think if you say T-cell lymphoma is not going to be that effective, you'll be right more than we would want you to be. Yeah, it's a good guess if you have to. The early data with the azacitidine looked amazing. It's now probably about a 30% response rate. But with HDAC inhibitors in follicular helper T cells, so if you kind of just match the subtype, it's closer to 50%. Looked a little more like 60% with the EZH inhibitor. So those are responses. They're not cures. Some of those are CRs. The CRs tend to be at about half of the responders. And those agents can be maintained without cumulative toxicity. So in the relapse setting, that's how those studies are being done. But adding them up front, I know it's a bit of a longer story, but there was a romidepsin plus CHOP study where a randomized study in France adding romidepsin to CHOP. It was sort of the reverse of echelon two. It added toxicity. It showed no benefit. But they went back and did a subset analysis of just the TFH patients, and they had a doubling of the PFS, and that was significant because it was unplanned, et cetera, et cetera. You know, it doesn't totally count. But we have other ways of giving HDAC inhibitors or other epigenetically targeted drugs that probably don't increase the toxicity to where you can't give the to where you cannot give the chemotherapy on time. Azacitidine is being studied with CHOP in a cooperative group alliance study. And then again, the valemetostat data with an EZH inhibitor looks like relatively low toxicity. So that would be another option to potentially combine up front.
I was just flashing on remembering asking Margaret Tempero why she got involved with pancreatic cancer, kind of thinking the same thing about you, although you've got the ALCA patients there that maybe boost you up a little bit, huh?
Yeah, it's, I don't know. I mean, it's a retrospective story, like, right, how you end up there. No, it's tough. I mean, there are patients with more indolent disease, and, you know, we do have patients who are doing fine, so it's not all doom and gloom, but definitely a lot of work still to be done.
All right, well, let's talk about your cases. Let's begin with your 50-year-old man with ALK-negative ALCL.
Yeah, so for ALK-negative ALCL, I think that was sort of the main target group of the Echelon 2 study. So that's the group that really we have the best data that they really do better. So really, regardless of prognostic factors, regardless of genetics, those patients all get PVCHP. Up front. In the ALK negative patients, because those still have a relapse rate, more than 30%, even after BVCHP, complete remission, we would still consolidate those patients with auto transplant if they were fit and amenable for that. In that case, I added, that patient had DUS22 rearrangement. There was some early data from Mayo that DUS22 rearrangement was favorable, similar to ALK expression. And I think now we have bigger data sets to show that that's probably an intermediate group. So they do better than the non-DUS22 rearrange, but probably not so much better that you would shorten or reduce therapy.
So what happened with this man and how did he end up getting to you?
Yeah, so diagnosed, by a local doctor with lymphadenopathy, biopsy shows CD30 positive T cell lymphoma, most consistent with ALK negative ALCL. And those are patients that, typically call and get referred in. Most of our patients are still self-referred.
So what happened with him? How was he treated and what happened?
So he received BVCHP kind of like a la the Echelon 2 study, had a complete response. And then based on good fitness, we have a discussion with the transplant team about consolidation, went on to consolidation with auto transplant, and so far has remained in remission.
How did you do on the initial chemo with the BV?
Pretty well. We see the typical side effects. He did not have dose reduction due to neuropathy, but most people will get grade 1 neuropathy, and usually we can get through 6 cycles without getting up to grade 2. And then the usual cytopenias, but for most of those patients, they're pretty manageable.
Globally, when you see these patients, what kind of a, cure rate do you quote to them?
For anaplastic large cell lymphoma with sort of the maximal approach, BVCHP plus auto transplant, it's probably about 60 or 70% of those are cured, probably 60% from the get-go and higher among the patients in complete remission at the end of initial therapy.
Anything else you want to say about this case and also the workup that he had and what that showed? Anything you want to say about that?
Yeah, I think, one of the things that I'm a proponent of is PET scans in patients with T-cell lymphoma because we see a lot of extranodal disease and it's useful in finding that disease and following that disease. This person had bone lesions, so that was reflective of that. The other point that we're seeing sometimes that gets a little fuzzy now is where in B-cell lymphomas and Hodgkin lymphoma, PET is reliable for bone marrow involvement. It's not in T-cell lymphomas. So if you're going to completely stage someone, you still need to look at the bone marrow. You can't rely on the PET scan alone sort of to rule that out. And then I don't know if you want to get into sort of the more complicated genetics. We have these different genetic groups now of ALK-negative anaplastic large cell lymphoma. There's TP63 rearranged, and those patients do quite poorly. They look like they're almost universally chemo refractory. This may get a little too detailed here, but that's not IHC staining. So this person had some P63 staining, but that's not the same as TP63 rearrangements. So if you want to look for that chemorefractory group, you have to do FISH on those patients. And then this patient had DUS22, which, as I mentioned, may be more favorable. We still treat them the same, but you probably get better outcomes with the same therapy with those who are DUS22 rearranged.
I'm having a little bit of a flashback to a session I did fairly recently with your colleague, Dr. Gounder. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, you guys are in such, you know, the areas that you're in are so complicated that I feel like there has to be a way to at least run cases by you electronically. Yeah. You know, I know that doesn't happen, but it just seems like everybody with peripheral T cell should have some tertiary doc looking at at least just globally what they're doing.
Yeah, if it's possible. I get a lot of emails. You know, I answer the ones I can. It's not always timely. But yeah, we don't really have a formal system. But I was recently in London. Like, we're working on a collaborative project there with some people at Imperial College. And in the UK, they have a tumor board, a national tumor board for all lymphoma cases, like, get presented at a national tumor board. I mean, we're a much bigger country, but it'd be nice if there was a way to sort of do that. Yeah. Yeah, because it is complicated. And even the nomenclature and the words, it's hard to explain simply. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the Talmud or something. It just has all these deep, you know, shades of complexity. But you guys understand it. And it seems a shame that oncologists are, I mean, to me, I think, relatively isolated. But you tell me, does that actually get translated into a difference? Or do you think there are things, mismanagement or misperceptions out there that are causing problems?
No, I don't. I think it's rarely mismanagement. I think we think about things in such a detailed way that I think a lot of the times it doesn't change the outcome. You're chemosensitive, you're chemoresistant, and that's really your fate. Your fate isn't that your doctor checked or understood what DUS22 means. So I don't think it's mismanagement. I think there are nuances where we probably shade the outcomes for a small subset of people, but I think the, like, validated clinical data are BVCHP versus CHOP. You know, these other sort of minor points, we don't have data that those result in true, like, you know, hard endpoints like progression-free or overall survival.
We recently did a think tank just on ALK-positive lung cancer. And since oncologists are getting exposed to multiple generations of those agents, can you talk a little bit about how, if at all, that fits into management of these patients?
Yeah, so ALK-positive ALCL, they respond to ALK inhibitors. There's a pediatric study looking at in combination upfront where there was some excess toxicity. So right now, they don't get ALK inhibitors standardly upfront. They get BVCHP for ALK-positive ALCL, and most of those patients are cured. Again, most being like 70%, you know, not 90%. In the relapse setting, ALK inhibitors have very high response rates. So patients go into remission 80%+ of the time, but they're not curative. So you either maintain them on ALK inhibitor or you bridge them to transplant with curative intent. We don't see ALK resistance like they do in lung cancer where there's mutational-based resistance. Some patients don't respond, but it's not as well understood, and we don't see acquired resistance. Where we use the later generation ALK inhibitors is there's a rate of CNS involvement in ALK-positive ALCL. So the newer agents, alectinib, brigatinib, some of those guys know better than I do, cross into the CNS. So if there is CNS disease, we're worried about it. We tend to use those newer agents as opposed to crizotinib, but the upfront response rate, you know, again, very small studies, looks quite similar.
You know, lorlatinib, they had some data presented at the last ASCO that was very impressive.
Oh, yeah. Right?
But I hear these stories about, you know, changing personalities, all kinds of, have you used lorlatinib incidentally?
No, we've used mostly crizotinib and then alectinib more recently, but I've not used lorlatinib right yet.
Yeah, that should be an interesting experience from what I'm hearing. Like the spouses don't recognize them or whatever.
So it's like a CNS penetration that causes like thought disturbance or it causes, yeah.
Yeah, like psychiatric things, personality things, all kinds of weird stuff. But they still use it because it's way better. You know, it's really good.
Yeah.
But still, it's kind of tricky drug. All right, 57-year-old man, PTCL NOS. What happened with him?
So this guy is PTCL NOS. So he's in one of these NOS categories, so not otherwise specified. This is a CD8 cytotoxic T cell lymphoma. So we're learning a little bit about these, But right now, what we kind of know is that they do worse with the same therapy. So our initial approach still for curative intent is combination chemotherapy for patients who are young enough or fit enough and CD30 negative, we'll add etoposide because we think that does a little better. It's particularly useful in patients that may have some underlying HLH. And then those in first remission will still follow with transplant, which we did in this case.
Anything else you want to say about the course of this patient or how the patient actually did win the treatment?
No, I mean, this patient tolerated the CHOP etoposide pretty well. We do see increased cytopenias. In some patients, we're able to give it every 2 weeks where there's a little data that it may be better. This patient, we could only give it every three based on cytopenias. He did get a CR and we did follow it with auto transplant, but he relapsed. It was between 6 and 9 months after that, which too often is the case for these patients, you know, with PTCL. We are learning about the CD8 positives, and a lot of these patients have activating mutations in the JAK-STAT pathway. And we have sort of clinical trials ongoing and recently finished looking at targeting that pathway in these patients where there's not curative, but there is a response rate.
With JAK inhibitors?
Yeah. My colleague Alison Mosco has published our ruxolitinib experience recently, and then we've just finished a study that's not out yet with ruxolitinib combining with duvelisib. And it looks like the patients with STAT mutations are pretty common, that those patients sort of have higher rates of response than those who don't have those mutations. There's another JAK inhibitor called galidesitinib, which was recently published a phase 2 study that also showed pretty good response rates in relapsed T-cell lymphoma. So that's probably a pathway that's worth targeting. And then there's like some STAT degraders. There's some other ways looking at targeting that pathway that are in early clinical trials.
So before we go into your next case, during your talk, you made some comments about mycosis fungoides. Anything you want to say about that, and particularly as it relates to brentuximab?
Yeah, I mean, you know, probably one of the best uses of brentuximab is in mycosis fungoides, where it's the highest response rate we have of any systemic therapy. So most of those patients, or many of those patients, will have some CD30 expression, even if it's very low. And brentuximab has really high rates of response, particularly in patients with diffuse skin like plaque disease or tumor disease or more nodular disease. In the main study looking at brentuximab, patients with Sézary were excluded, so we have much less data for those. But for patients with tumor stage MF or transformed MF, which is a more aggressive form often accompanying the larger tumors, they have a really high response rate, so we use it quite frequently. The only real drawback there is for most of our treatments for mycosis fungoides, we use maintenance or ongoing therapy. And at full dose brentuximab, you know, you can't give it forever. There is cumulative neuropathy. So we have some studies looking at lower doses. There's a new version that's just early in clinical trial now that may have less neuropathy risk. So it's super effective for those patients and something that we use a lot.
All right, let's talk about your 71-year-old lady with AITL.
Yeah, so angioimmunoblastic T-cell lymphoma we talked about is sort of the most common type of follicular helper T-cell lymphoma. Often these patients have fairly extensive disease. You know, if you see sort of in that pre-picture on the left there on the PET scan, you know, you have very small volume nodes that often have SUVs, you know, just above background 3 to 4. And that's kind of a typical presentation, and they may have other areas of larger adenopathy. I think just to highlight, like, her T cells sort of fit the typical TFH phenotype, CD4 positive, PD1 positive, not available in all labs, but CXCL13, ICOS are usually positive. And she had 10% CD30 expression, so sort of met the eligibility criteria for the Echelon 2 study. So we treated her with BVCHP. Our alternative approaches like CHOP etoposide are really often too toxic for a 70-year-old. And then the new upfront studies that are going on through the Alliance weren't open at that time. So she was treated with BVCHP. She did quite well and had a complete response, but shortly after completing treatment, developed new lung nodules. And that biopsy actually in her was an EBV positive B-cell lymphoma, which we sometimes see at relapse or progression of AITL. So then that was treated with rituximab.
Rituximab alone?
Yeah. Well, yeah. It had just come after chemotherapy. So the thought was we probably were not dealing with curative intent there because it was refractory to chemotherapy and in her 70s, just finishing chemo. The EBV positive B-cell lymphoma in AITL sometimes is like a frank aggressive lymphoma, and sometimes it's a little more like an EBV expansion. So some of those patients you can knock it down with rituximab and then see what happens.
So what's the patient's current status?
So she had a good response to rituximab and stayed in remission for about a year, then ended up progressing with her T-cell lymphoma and then going on to other therapies.
Would you expect bispecific or CAR T to work in her?
If the B-cell lymphoma came back or the B-cell lymphoma was refractory, I think it could. I don't think we've treated anyone. I have to think if we've treated anyone with relapse after AITL with that. I don't think we've treated anyone with CAR T, but when it's a frank DLBCL, I think you'd manage those just like DLBCL based on those patient specific findings. And I think some of those T cell lymphomas that are reported after CAR T, I don't know if you guys have talked about that much at all.
Those
cases, some of those are probably people who had underlying angioimmunoblastic T cell lymphoma that wasn't appreciated because sometimes the large B cell lymphoma is the dominant process at diagnosis, and you'll treat those people with, R-CHOP, and then at recurrence, you see the T-cell lymphoma. And when we see those people, often we've been able to go back and find evidence of the T-cell lymphoma in the genetics from the baseline sample. So we think those are probably people that have both a follicular helper T-cell lymphoma and an EBV-driven large B-cell lymphoma. So some of those cases, the T-cell lymphoma, we think was pre-existing and not just post-CAR. That makes sense, yeah.
That's really cool. I've never heard that one before.
There's some interesting, it's that follicular helper biology is sort of interesting.
That's really interesting. You referred to newer trials in the upfront setting. Can you talk about what's being looked at both in the United States and elsewhere?
Yeah, the main upfront study we have right now is through the cooperative group led by the Alliance, and it's a randomized phase two. So it's looking at adding azacitidine or oral azacitidine to CHOP or CHOEP based on the age of the patients, or duvelisib, PI3 kinase inhibitor, to CHOP or CHOEP or a standard arm of CHOP or CHOEP. So that's sort of looking to pick a winner if one of those new agents is better, CR rate's the primary endpoint, either overall or based on biology. And, our guess is if it's really better, it's probably going to be in a follicular helper T-cell lymphoma population where both of those new agents have better efficacy. That's the main upfront study. There is a study, I don't know if it's open yet, in France where they're trying to do early biopsies and then stratify patients based on biology. So follicular helper patients would get, chemotherapy plus X, PTCL NOS would get chemotherapy plus something different. I think ALCL would get chemotherapy plus BV or something. I've seen the design of that study, but I don't know if it's open yet. And then there's some effort to look at transplant consolidation in a randomized fashion, which I have some concerns about the one-size-fits-all strategies, but there's some studies in the works that I think will look at that.
I'm still ruminating a little bit over what you said about those secondary T-cell lymphomas with CAR-T. Has that been observed in any other situation?
With CAR-T or with just other treatment?
Other treatments where you sort of are uncovering, from what you're describing, it sounds like you're sort of uncovering a T cell once you treat the other one.
Yeah, the thing I think it's most analogous to is when you have like de novo transformation of follicular lymphoma. So you have large cell lymphoma because the big node was biopsied, you treat, and then 2 years later there's a relapse and it's follicular and you see that maybe it was there before, but you just didn't find it. Because sometimes the AITL, are these small nodes, they're kind of low proliferative rate. And then if the EBV, you usually see some EBV positive B cells or immunoblasts in the biopsy. Sometimes those sort of outgrow and become the dominant process, and you see sheets of these large EBV positive B cells. So we think there's a concurrent B cell lymphoma. But sometimes at the initial biopsy, like that's what you see. So you think it's all DLBCL you treat, and then we find the T cell later. You know, I work in a weird environment where we only see T cell lymphomas, but we see that story, you know, five times a year. We'll see a patient referred with a T cell lymphoma that had a history of DLBCL. And if you can get the original material, often you can find the T cell there at baseline.
Interesting. Cause you know, I mean, I don't know, somehow I always thought it was weird to have a T cell lymphoma as a secondary consequence of therapy, but the way you're explaining it makes a lot more sense.
Yeah. And I think those CAR T T cells are heterogeneous. Like some are LGL, they're different things. There's a couple that really look like they're secondary, like the genetics and, you know, you have product earlier and you can look and they really look like they're secondary. But we see that. But then the other thing that we've seen, like again, with the clonal hematopoiesis is in the patients that have both B and T cell lymphoma from AITL, you'll see those same clonal hematopoietic mutations like TET2, and then you'll see different mutations in the T cell lymphoma and then different mutations in the B cell lymphoma. So there's probably some story, some underlying susceptibility there that I don't really understand, but maybe somebody does.
I'm also flashing back to my conversation with Dr. Gounder, where I said in the beginning, I never imagined we could talk. I think we were talking about desmoid or something, and somehow we managed to talk for a whole hour about it. So same story here. This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Horwitz, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.